Hello there, and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. So today what I want to talk to you about is Ed Wood. Now, I think it's quite fair to say that, you know, a lot of people will know Ed Wood from the film, the Tim Burton movie, about his life, which plays a quite, you know, romanticised image of the man, and kind of then stops short straight after Plan 9 from Outer Space, with Wood gleefully looking at the film on the big screen, pleased of what he's achieved. Wood's portrayed as a bit of a romantic and quite blind to some of the stuff some of the quality of the work that he's been doing. But also, you know, he kind of is incredibly resourceful in terms of what he wants to achieve. In 1992, Rudolph Gray actually did a biography of the man, Nightmare of Ecstasy, The Life and Art of Edward D. Wood Jr., which kind of forms a basis of what a lot of our biographical understanding of the life of Ed Wood was like. And that portrays a slightly different version of the man, but nonetheless shows him to be, you know, a man who was friends with Lugosi, who done much, and it was people speaking about him fondly quite a lot after his death. So yeah, I mean, there are stories there about the man. Of course, in 1980, he was at 2 years after his death, he'd been awarded the Golden Turkey Award for the worst director of all time, which kind of kick-started interest in his work, in particular a period of time in the 50s and 60s, rather than his work a little bit later. A couple of years ago, and I'll throw this, my own story in, I did a screening of Plan 9 from Outer Space at a community cinema in Liverpool, and it was very popular, sold out. Someone actually wrote a review of the night that I'd done, and she hadn't seen Plan 9 before. And when we started, we showed some trailers before the film to kind of get people kind of loosened up and into the mood, and, you know, to set the tone. So there was, you know, Attack of the Crab Monsters and that kind of 1950s schlocky, good fun films. And the crowd reacted, as you probably imagine they would, with mirth towards the films, towards the trailers, and then towards the film. And the initial thought was that people would be punching down a bit, like just laughing at the effects. But then kind of an understanding that there's a great deal of warmth for Ed Wood's work, particularly Plan 9, but around it as well. He's a unique figure. His reputation as being a bad director, and I mean that as in the truest sense of the term, that he is a director who is poor at what he does, is unfounded in truth. And I wrote an article around the screening, you know, just to get a bit of copy on the internet to kind of, you know, drive people to the site. And that article was very much about the fact that the concept of bad movies seems to have changed over the last, well, 10 years, say. A lot of the shift in terms of how films are moved, people kind of, or certainly the Golden Turkeys, shifted from being about films that were entertaining in the way they've been executed to being like one in the eye for Hollywood, you know, handing out things for, I don't know, Batman vs Superman, a film that made a lot of money but possibly wasn't the fan favourite that people had hoped for. Which kind of puts us again to Ed Wood and his artwork and his craft. Now, there's two ways we could do this, really. One would be to kind of do it as a biography of Wood, kind of go through his life and his career and try and decipher who he is. But I think instead what we'll do is kind of just look at the films, speak about the movies, and kind of say, Ed, in a modern term, what is a bad director? He's not a bad director. He's a unique voice. He's different. He's got a tin ear for dialogue, I'll give him that. But his works are, on the whole, entertaining. And when he's, you know, those Ed Woody elements are removed, his films are actually quite decent. Obviously, his life kind of shifts somewhat a little bit later on in the films, when his career effectively changes. But apart from that, he is certainly worth reappraisal. So Ed was born on October 10th, 1924. More than just a director, he was a general filmmaker in a very low budget kind of way. So he produced, he wrote, he appeared in movies. He's known, obviously, for his transvesticism, which he carried on throughout his life. He was interested in pulp and comics, westerns, serials, anything with elements of voodoo in it as well. And on his 12th birthday in 1936, he received a film camera and managed to catch the Hindenburg shortly before it crashed on film. During the Second World War, he enlisted in the military and was injured in action and finally discharged. From there, in 1947, he decides to become involved in films, something he'd been interested in already. Woods had already worked as a writer and had done a couple of TV pilots that hadn't really taken off. There was a desire for a low-budget film which kind of cashed in a very much an exploitation style on the Christine Jorgensen, who'd had a sex change operation and become a celebrity in the process of that. So it needs to be cheap and it needs to be a quickie. But he couldn't get the rights to A Life, but he still wanted to cash in. So he wants to make a generic sex change movie, which were, in fairness, relatively popular for rubbernecking people at that stage. So Woods, who at the time made nothing really, a couple of aborted TV pilots, pitches himself to be the perfect man to direct a film about transvesticism. In a sense, because he is one, and therefore understands these people and how they think. Already been introduced by this stage to an actor called Bela Lugosi, who we all know as, you know, Todd Browning's Dracula, by a friend and writer-producer Alex Gordon. Now, Gordon appears a little bit in the earlier stuff of Wood's creative career, helping him write. Gordon shared a room with Wood. Lugosi was not in a good way. He'd been addicted to morphine because he'd been using it to control the pain from his sciatica. And his physically was very, very frail. Lugosi's son, Bela Lugosi Jr., states that he felt that Ed Wood was exploiting the relationship to try and make cheap films at a point in Lugosi's life where he would not have been able to refuse any work at all. In that book, which we speak about, Nightmare of Ecstasy, it suggested that isn't the case, that they were actually genuinely friends and continue to be friends right the way up to his death. However, it's all easy to understand and have an opinion on why that would be a problem and why he, you know, Junior, his son, would feel like that, particularly because with Glenn and Glenda, one of the contributing factors to getting the deal was the fact that Ed Wood could bring Lugosi on board, which would provide enough of a name to actually kind of get the job done and get the film. Glenn and Glenda is an interesting film. It feels like almost like in Ed Wood's excitement to create the film, he wrote and directed it, and stars as the star, is that he wants to cram in as many thoughts and ideas as he possibly can into the structure and into the film itself. So you get bits of flashbacks and lectures, and Lugosi pops up seemingly as some kind of godlike figure. So the script itself is relatively autobiographical, apparently, centered around his life with his girlfriend, Dolores Fuller. And Fuller indeed plays her counterpart, Barbara, in the film. it's framed around a suicide of somebody who was a transvestite that kills themselves because of society's reaction to them. Before kind of darting all over the place and using flashbacks and bits and bobs to kind of mash together some kind of more like a lecture than a narrative in truth. And it's surreal in many ways. Our suicide victim actually recites his own suicide note out. And there's dance sequences and all sorts of random ideas that appear to occur to Wood at random. As he's writing the scripts as quickly as he could to get it made. But certainly I think what he wanted to do was kind of encapsulate exactly how he felt. Wood deliberately made Glenda look incredibly masculine. And what that does for the film is kind of get a cheap laugh, really. But his opinions were that he should make it grubby, not make it too feminine. And then at the end, you've got to get the bit in there, which is, keep the producer happy. So you've got an hour of Wood effectively describing his own feelings on transvestism. And then this 10-minute sprint through a sex change. I think, generally, it's a plea for understanding. And Wood does this again and again throughout his career. He kind of... These basic forces, you know, if everyone was kind of better with each other and nicer with each other, the world would be a better place, which is something it's difficult to argue with in truth. One of the elements that's important to point out about Glenn and Glenda is, regardless of its structure, which probably is where we're going to have to effectively kind of criticise it the most, although it isn't a particularly tightly made film, it is genuinely trying not to make a cheap gag out of its subject matter, which is something that you would traditionally expect. It's for gawping at, you know. And I think that honesty, that cultural heart, really kind of help it. I think then that's probably one of the things that I'll say about a lot of the movie as we move forward, most movies as we move forward. He attempts to kind of, regardless of if it's his best work or his worst, they're always kind of, they drag the audience along with them, and they're always interesting, if not necessarily, you know, well put together.
Comes the major surgery, the removal of the man and the formation of the woman. A woman born at the age of 24.
A new life is begun.
The body of the woman within begins to appear now. The world is shocked by a person who changed his sex. Thus, the strange case of Glenn, who was Glenda, one and the same person, not half man, half woman, but nevertheless, man and woman in the same body. He dares to enter the street dressed in the clothes he so much desires to wear.
Glenn is engaged to be married to Barbara. Glenn's problem is a deep one, but he must tell her soon. She's begun to notice things. Soon she will realize. He learned that foreign doctors were doing marvelous work with a sex change. Man to woman, woman to man.
Say, did you read about the guy that had his sex changed to a girl? Says he was perfectly normal, too.
How can a guy be normal and go and do a thing like that to himself?
What about their children, Doctor? Would their children become the same way their father is?
Glenda has made the decision.
If the newspapers had not gotten hold of the story, it would have gone untold, unnoticed as so many others in medical history.
Why is the modern world shocked by this headline? Why?
Do you realize what would happen if every man in the country that wanted to wear women's clothes or felt like a woman went to their doctors and wanted a sex change?
Glenn and all the hundreds of thousands of other Glens across the nation face quite a problem.
Two years later, he works with this roommate again called Alex Gordon. And they set to work creating a melodrama called Jailbait. Now, jailbait obviously is a phrase, is something that's deliberately exploitative to try and catch the attention. But the film itself isn't. It's certainly not a film about, you know, it's not a sleazy sex comedy or that something like that. It's very much a melodrama. And Alex Gordon influences Wood clearly here. Jailbait is a simple B movie, but it's solidly and competently put together. Lugosi was meant to star, but it actually went to Herbert Rollins, who again was a former star who kind of fell on hard times. Indeed, Rollins was suffering from a cancer and died pretty much straight after film. And you get this story. This story about a guy called Clancy Malone, who's a delivery boy, who effectively meets with Ed Wood, who, you know, he works for, with him, kind of dropping stuff off. And then ends up somehow in his film as like the lead character. And basically, you know, it's about a couple of young lads who kind of get into trouble. And, you know, they've got guns and stuff like that. And indeed, the jailbait of the title is in fact a weapon. So it kind of tries to, well, it's about, you know, young lads, delinquents who, get themselves into a bit of hot water that's above what they can handle. I think what Jailbait is, it sits quite comfortably as a 1950s B-movie. Its problems lie in its script, which again features Ed Wood's tin ear. And, you know, people kind of speaking a little bit too much about what the audience should be thinking, shall we say. And also, you know, it's a bit corny and a little bit literal, but it's certainly not terrible. It sits very comfortably within that canon of film. And despite its simplicity and indeed it is a fun film to watch. And it kind of, you know, sets Ed Wood up as being kind of a jobbing director. He's not terrible. Now, 1955 saw Bride of the Monster, which does have William Thompson as as his cinematographer. And I think, you know, there's a joke obviously that he's colorblind, but Thompson's a great, was not a bad cinematographer, and being colorblind is not a big problem if you're filming in black and white, which they were. This time he'd spoken up with Dolores Fuller and had decided to replace her for whatever reason. But they'd already broken up, and it's possible that that relationship had broken down to a point that, you know, they weren't able to work together anymore. Although Loretta King was thought to have some money, although she didn't. And Tony McCoy, who was the son of one of the investors, plays a good role in truth and is in the film quite well. Again, this Bride of the Monster, and let's ignore the ridiculous monster effect in it, you know what I mean? It's a wonderful thing, in fairness, the monsters. You know, and who doesn't like, you know, a cheap mechanical beast in the middle of their 50s sci-fi movie? Lugosi pops up again. And this also features Tor Johnson as well, who effectively is, you know, in three of the movies. Who is in, you know, he is a regular contributor in the same way Lugosi is. And then Paul Marco as well, who appears in three of the films as a character called Kelton the Cop. And this is the first one of that, what is effectively a trilogy of films. So you've got mad scientists, you've got some monster, there's an allusion to the Loch Ness Monster. Bride of the Monster features a lot of strange elements, and you know, it's a 50s clanger of a B movie, but it's well written to a point. It features a bit of his dialogue, and Lugosi probably gets the best out of Lugosi he can do at this stage in Lugosi's career. It's a little flat in terms of how it's put together. It's very in the frame, shall we say, but it has pacing of the 1950s clangery B movie monster movies. It might not be the best looking one, and it shows its budgetary constraints, but it's a lot of fun.
The girl to my quarters.
Janet's car?
Yeah. There's not a trace of it.
Did you hear me?
You will be soon as big as a giant, or like all the others, dead.
Alice Gordon moved away from Ed Wood at this time and became a producer of AIP, American International Pictures, which kind of became quite a driving force in B-movies moving forward. I think it's fair to say at this point, Wood was a jobbing film director. He was good enough. With Gordon's absence, Wood effectively kind of unravels as a filmmaker, and we get his most famous work, Plan 9 from Outer Space. The story of that film is reaped in lore and myths and legends, and it's easy to we could get trapped down a rabbit hole just talking about Plan 9. And I don't, as I said, I don't want to be like, well, this bit's true, and I think this bit's true, not true. Mainly because, you know, God, who knows? It's not like there was a documentary film in the film on Plan 9 from Outer Space. It came from originally, Wood had filmed some B footage for what appears to be a couple of different movies, in truth, for with Lugosi, but Lugosi becomes incredibly ill at this stage and then dies in hospital. So Wood kind of goes, well, I've got this footage, we should use it, and then cobbles together a script that kind of uses the footage but doesn't use the footage. I think the thing about this one is he scrambled to get the money together. And it is incredibly cheap. And there are points when, you know, it's so unadvisable, some decision making he's done. You know, shots flipping from day to night, with little effort to mask the fact, to the point that narratively it's quite complicated to follow because your brain wonders what's actually happening and why as time passed, etc. The sets are very ambitious, but without the budget. He uses shower curtains for backdrop because, you know, there are a lot of different location work needed and he hasn't got the money for that. So we get inside of an airplane, which is little more than a cardboard door. We get the inside of spaceships, which are little more than shower curtains. We get graveyards, which look a little bit like they're made out of styrofoam or cardboard. And some of the strangest ideas, such as Vampira not speaking, but giving Tor Johnson, who is, I'm sure, a lovely man, speaking roles, which he struggles to articulate through them. You know, he was, after all, more on the wrestling side of things than he was on the addiction side of stuff. What is Plan 9's story? It's an alien movie. It's an alien invasion movie with zombies in it. That in itself isn't that surprising. You know, zombies, they are people raised from the dead using a heat ray. They're not actually still alive. They're kind of controlled by some heat, you know, some gamma rays or whatever, a laser. And the story itself is one about, you know, looking for and hoping for peaceful resolution. You know, it's a call for love in the world, hidden in the middle of some very, very Ed Wood style-y dialogue. And its fame, the film's fame, is mainly due to that kind of issue. So it has been declared one of the worst movies ever made. But as I've said, and this is my genuine thoughts on this stuff, Plan 9 cannot be the worst movie ever made, certainly not by modern standards of what is, because it is so entertaining to watch. You get a crowd of people in a room and you put that on and they love it. It's just insane. To a point that the film doesn't work as well when you watch it on your own, but collectively as a group, you kind of you will them on, and it, you know, and you, and he continues to surprise as the story goes on with its ideas and its concepts, and its dialogue. It's unrelenting in its unusual kind of nature, and its strange kind of concepts. And it's good because of that, while simultaneously not being good, if that makes sense. Wood's artistry with Plan 9 elevates it to a higher level of entertainment than a cheaply made sci-fi movie. Because there are sci-fi movies that look well worse than this, that are unwatchable, boring. There is dialogue that is poorer than this because you can't listen to it. Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space is a very pure essence of what is a bad movie, because when you watch it, you're actually having a good time. It's a bad movie as form of entertainment rather than cinematic critique. After that, he makes Night of the Ghouls, which is the third of this trilogy of movies with his Kelton the Cop character, a trilogy that no one, I think, calls a trilogy. but that character does sit through all three films, so in a sense, you know, that they do tie together. And indeed, in Night of the Ghouls, the events of Brad the Monster and Plan 9 are kind of alluded to. Griswold reappears as well and kind of narrates us into the story, as he did with Plan 9. Tor Johnson reappears as Lobo as well. So these kind of returning characters kind of all flood together. And Plan 9 was actually on the shelf when Night of the Ghouls appears, but, you know, that's the nature of these things, I suppose. And on the remains of the house of Bride of the Monster, a new home is built, and Sumsy can apparently lift the loved ones back from the dead. And the film itself is kind of played up for laughs. I think Wood's aware of what he's cheating, you know, of where his strengths may be. But the problem with that is Night of the Ghouls a bit more competent than Plan 9. So he's made a film that he tries to kind of get, you know, milk the laughs out of, but he doesn't quite understand why the other stuff's quite so funny. So we get a film that that awkwardly sits between comedy and horror, and it's a bit slow. It doesn't feature quite... its biggest problem is it isn't Ed Wood enough. I think that would be probably fair to say, and that's where it kind of struggles. So we get mad, you know, but that trilogy of films is quintessentially what people think of as Ed Wood. So, you know, mad scientists and aliens and zombies and monsters and all sorts of crazy stuff going on all the way through it.
I am Criswell. For many years I have told you the almost unbelievable, related the unreal, and showed it to be more than fact. Now I tell you a tale of the Threshold people. So astounding that some of you may faint, this is a story of those in the twilight time. Once human, now monsters, in a world between the living and the dead. Monsters to be pitied, monsters to be despised.
From there, Woods shifts tone again. Goes back to a kind of a grimmer, grittier kind of storytelling technique. 1960 sees The Sinister Urge. It's about a rapist who is going around stabbing young women. And it kind of gets tied into a porn ring as well. And the kind of the head of the porn ring kind of gets herself a psychotic to kind of be muscle effectively and kill the people. And every time he watches pornography, he becomes this evil killer, hence the name of The Sinister Urge. So yeah, so I mean, The Sinister Urge is a quite, it's quite an interesting, quite sleazy exploitation film, B-movie. And Edwards appears to have kind of, you know, pulled together a decent film. You know, you could turn around and say, you know, it's quite brave, really, for the way it's been designed, because it's, you know, it's interesting in terms of covering a, you know, a subject matter in a more honest style, a more interesting style. But I think when we see where he goes next, it's pretty clear that Edward is not concerned about how how daring he wants to be. I think he just knows that, you know, being honest and being exploitative works. After The Sinister Urge, he kind of shifted more into screenplays and teamed up with a guy called A.C. Stevens, beginning with a film called Orgy of the Dead, which is a mixture of nudie cootie and horror. So we get lots and lots of strippers and lots of zombies, and sometimes some zombie strippers as well. And all of it's kind of, you know, quite sleazy, if we're being honest with you. Wood created 12 scripts up to his death for A.C. Stevens to direct. Some of it is kind of stuff for the drive-ins and truth. Five Loose Women would be an indicator of something a little bit better in terms of it's kind of, you know, escaped convicts, women in prison stuff on the run. Designed for driving audience, still a bit sleazy for being honest, but a lot of the stuff also falls more into porn in truth. And indeed Wood would only direct three more films since then, all of which are pornography, in particular Nympho Cycler and Take It Out and Trade, which are, you know, exactly what you'd imagine they would be. And probably, you know, most typified by Necromania, A Tale of Weird Love. a story about a couple who are having marital problems who, for some reason, decide a necromancer would be the best way to go. So you get rituals with skulls and two different versions of the film, one softcore and one hardcore. Apparently Ed was severely struggling with the booze by the time he'd reached around to the 70s, and I think a lot of the fight had gone out of him. And those films are exactly what you'd imagine they would be. They're at the very least trying to stand out from the crowd, and Wood has actually written scripts for them, although that's not that uncommon for pornography at the time. You know, they are very much what they are. I mean, as well as, but you know, we can also move away from the fact that, you know, he wasn't just making films, although he actually wrote 80 novels for his life, and a lot of them based on these scripts that became films and the other way around. So, you know, Orgy of the Dead gets a book. So does, in fact, Necromania. You know, these are trash pulp novels designed for the very much, you know, it's low common denominator stuff. So, in 1978, you know, his depression had worsened, and him and his wife, Kathy O'Hara, who he'd married actually in 1959, had very badly fallen into problems with the source. They were evicted from their apartment. They managed to find a somewhere to live from an actor friend called Peter Coe, who could give them somewhere to stop them from being homeless. Apparently Wood had spent a weekend drinking vodka, trying to, for whatever reason, numb the world out. He said he felt ill, went to lie down, shouted that he couldn't breathe, but Kathy had basically decided not to go and check on him because she felt probably that he was crying shy, and obviously alcoholic makes you act different ways. And he died of a heart attack. Wood was cremated and his ashes spread to sea. And that's it. And I know I've kind of focused on, you know, his early career and not his later work. And I know that will frustrate certain fans the 70s porn, I suppose. But for me, Wood is at his best when he's overcoming problems, fighting for what he wants to do, and creating films that are interesting, different, strange, throwing as much ideas together as he can, and a unique voice in film. I'm going to finish on one final story. A friend gave me a film and said, "Have you seen this movie?" I was like, "No, man, no, I haven't." It's an Ed Wood. Now, I hadn't seen, I mean, it was a while ago, but I hadn't heard the name of before. And I was a bit confused because I just assumed it was one of the ones he'd written a screenplay for, and I was right. Bit concerned when it came up in colour, because that's normally an indicator it's his later period. And sure enough, the 10-minute sex scene at the start of the film featuring three women decided to inform me that it was porno. And Ed had only had a uncredited screen title credit, which kind of surprised me, because you don't normally get handed porn over to people. You know, yeah, do you want to add some porn? But there you go. I just don't think he'd watched it in truth and had Ed Wood on the title, so he thought, you know, I'd like it. He was handing over stacks of stuff to me, like mid-noughties Argento movies and, you know, recent crappy zombie films. Once again, as always, an indicator that Ed can always surprise you. I suppose that's the first thing to say. And it does feature one of the most hilarious use of special effects, which is played for laughs in fairness, but does feature a toy, you know, three-inch dinosaur plastic character as the effect of a dinosaur in it. The film's called 1 Million ACDC. I wouldn't recommend you search it out, but it certainly surprised me when it went on. So Wood's kind of, for me, a bit of a shorthand now. A shorthand for a certain kind of film, a certain kind of enjoyment that you can get from that film. And I think that's, although almost certainly not what he'd wanted to achieve from his career, fitting for somebody who was so desperate to make films and was willing to really kind of cut the corners that he felt was needed, but was still willing to do, to create a movie of great quality.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Thanks very much for that. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com. Go to Twitter, and that's @orange_monkey. Or you can go and go to thelasthorrorpodcast.com, leave comments on any of the articles and stuff like that. That's all good. If you want to... Also, I send out a weekly mixtape, which is a Spotify playlist of different tracks, which kind of associates with the films. So we'll be doing that this week as well, with some kind of Edward theme, I'm sure. Next week is a week off. I'm not here next week. So sorry about that. I'm away. So what we're going to do is take a week off, and then we are going to return with something a little different. We're going to talk about a book I've read recently and a game I've played recently. A book's called The Last Days of Jack Sparks, and the game is called Sarah is Missing. So, until then, take care. Speak soon.